The next case is State of Minnesota versus Tamez. Are both of the lawyers arguing from Clay County in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're both present. Excellent. Could we hear then from the lawyer representing Mr. Tamez? And let me know if I pronounced that incorrectly. I apologize if I did.
I believe it is Mr. Tamez, Your Honor. This is Attorney Drew Hushka of the Vogel Law Firm appearing for the appellant in this case.
Okay, would you approach the podium and begin your argument, please? And could you spell your last name for the record, because your name is not on our calendar?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. I'm on the briefs. My name is Drew, Drew, Hushka, Hushka.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, the issue before the court today is whether or not continued prosecution of Mr. Tamez violates his double jeopardy protections. It is the position of the defendant and the appellant in this case that because there is no evidence of a manifest necessity before the district court when the mistrial was declared, that continued prosecution violates the double jeopardy clause. We would ask that the district court be reversed and the case be remanded with an order to dismiss the charges against Mr. Tamez. Now, the facts in this case for the court are not in dispute, but the state and the defendant vary greatly on the legal significance. Trial in this case began on July 10th. At that time, a voir dire was had, and in the afternoon of the 10th on a Tuesday, a jury was impaneled and sworn in. Now, before the jury being impaneled, the court discussed with counsel for both sides on how long the trial was expected to take and how much time was available. It was scheduled for a two-day trial, and a full day on Tuesday and Friday was available, and a half day on Wednesday was also available. As I said, the voir dire lasted the full day on Tuesday, and the jury was sent home. On Wednesday, when the case resumed, the parties were nearly finished with oral argument on Wednesday afternoon by the time a mistrial was declared. Therefore, at that point, two full days remained for a jury trial that was scheduled to last 2 days, and significant portions had already concluded.
I'm sorry, did the mistrial, counsel, the mistrial occurred
Wednesday afternoon, Your Honor.
During opening statements, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, not during closing arguments. Okay, during opening statements. Okay.
I apologize. My statement was wrong. The state had provided its full opening statement. Mr. Tamez was nearing the end of the conclusion of his opening statement, as I understand it.
Thank you.
And could you clarify me just in terms of scheduling? As I understand it, the state became aware at one point that the defense had talked to the state's witnesses and had a written report or a summary of their statement and wanted to be provided that statement and asked for a period of time within which to review that statement. How much time did the state ask for when it initially said, I want to see the statement from my witness?
Yes, Your Honor. When the issue originally came to light, now I'm in a similar position to the court as I came into this case simply for the appellate argument. And so I'm only familiar with the underlying facts as are in the transcripts in this case. And how I understood it is that the issue came to light on Monday when the subpoena went out to the law clerk in this case. And on Tuesday, when that issue was resolved, they said that if the disclosure was made that evening, that was sufficient time to begin to continue the trial as is. They didn't request any additional time besides that it be disclosed on Tuesday night before trial resumed on Wednesday.
Okay. And then during the trial, the state hears some, or during opening argument, hears something that it wasn't expected, goes to look at the disclosure and realizes it wasn't attached to the email.
Correct, Your Honor. That is my understanding.
How much time did the state request at that point to get up to speed once the disclosure was then made?
Your Honor, the state did not request any additional time. The state simply asked for exclusion and offered no. It did not appear in the record that the state thought any amount of time would be sufficient for a continuance. There was no specific request of a day or 2 days or anything else. It simply asked that anything that had not been disclosed and that attachment be excluded at that point.
And did the defense propose a short continuance or?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Mr. Kohler specifically argued that primarily a continuance should be the remedy for the issue. That exclusion would deprive the defendant of a fair trial, of the ability to fully present his defense, and that continuance would be the best remedy. He did not specifically outline a length of the continuance, but that a continuance should be how the district court should go forward.
But counsel also stated, according to the quote in the state's brief, or do a mistrial and start over in response to the district court's question.
Your Honor, and that was stated as an option that the court could pursue, but it was not a way that it was not an option that Mr. Kohler advocated for. And I think there's two issues in this case.
How do we know that?
Because it was the primary argument. If the transcripters review, it's almost said at the very end of a sentence as an aside that these are the options that the court has. It can exclude it. It should continue it. Or it could grant a mistrial, but he did not advocate for the mistrial at any point. And I guess on that point, what I would say is I'm a recent father, and if I tell my kids that, you know, these are my rules, you can live under my house or you can move out, I'm not actually advocating for my child to move out. I'm just identifying those are what the options are. And I think in this case, it was pretty clear that Mr. Kohler was arguing that exclusion was a sledgehammer for a fly and that a continuance in this the much better solution for all involved.
Did Mr. Tamas oppose a mistrial? At any point, did he at any point let the district court know that he was opposed to a mistrial, if that was a direction the district court was going to go?
Your Honor, there was not an opportunity, I would say, for Mr. Tamas to weigh in one way or another.
Well, I mean, the district court sort of announcing its decision on the record and explaining its reasoning, does the defense at any point say, you know, Your Honor, we don't want a mistrial, we think you should just do the continuance, or do the defense just sort of go along with it?
Mr. Kohler did not raise anything orally, Your Honor, and if the transcript was viewed, he did not have the opportunity. The court came out and said, I'm declaring a sua sponte and a mistrial unless the state agrees that we can go forward in this case. He was not provided an opportunity short of interrupting the court and saying, you know, Your Honor, I disagree with this mistrial. There was not any opportunity for Mr. Kohler to actively object to the mistrial, I believe, in this case. And, Your Honor, the issue is whether or not the record contains evidence of a manifest necessity in this case. In this case, the district court retired to its chambers for approximately 10 minutes, and it came back out and said, yeah, continuance isn't possible, and it did not provide any additional clarification on that. But the record in this case is clear is that the jury that were already seated in this case were scheduled for the jury term of a month, that it was the same jury term when trial was rescheduled to come back in a month for those very same jurors. But the court did not seem to consider whether or not the jurors could be recalled in that month's time. It did not check with the jurors for whether or not there was an issue for that they could not come back for. The court simply decided that I'm releasing these jurors and we're going to come back in a month. And even though it's the same jury term, even though the jurors theoretically are available, I'm not going to see if they're available or not, I'm going to declare a mistrial. And I believe the case law is clear, is that the manifest necessity is, quote, an objective necessity apparent not only to the district court, or apparent not only to the district court, end quote. That there's nothing in this record that's apparent what the manifest necessity is. A conclusion is not factual support for it. If the court says that a continuance isn't feasible, if that's sufficient justification, any justification will do. The record in this case is that if it was continued to the next day, what was scheduled and what was still available to the trial court for that week could have concluded the trial. There's nothing in the record for why next week wouldn't work besides the court saying a continuance isn't feasible. There's nothing in the record for this court to review to actually confirm whether or not a continuance was or was not feasible. And it deprives this court of a simple justification. If it deprives this court of its appellate review requirements, that a conclusion can't suffice without factual support for it.
My understanding is that there was a motion in limine brought by the state that had been granted that evidence that had not been disclosed would be excluded. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so
yes.
It seemed to me the district court here was looking at, to be consistent with that ruling and with this non-disclosed evidence, the choice was either exclude it, which the district court felt was prejudicial to the appellant, or to begin again. And so, you know, there was more to the analysis than just, you know, do these jurors have time to come back?
Your Honor, I guess reviewing the transcripts, that's not how it occurred to me. I believe the court said that it could exclude it, that it was within its providence, and that the rules do allow that, but it would deny a fair hearing in that. But to remedy that, it could have the evidence be disclosed, and therefore it would be disclosed evidence that could be considered. And whether or not a continuance of a day, or a half week, or a week, or 2 weeks was an alternative. I do not believe there's any record in the transcripts or the record before this court for why or not that a continuance of even a week or 2 weeks or even a month to when the trial was eventually rescheduled for, why that was not feasible.
Counsel, does the reason a mistrial was declared factor into the analysis at all? My recollection of case law, and I don't see it cited in the briefs, is there something about, well, if one side prompts a mistrial, but perhaps that it's a circumstance where the state prompts a mistrial.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you're getting to that. If the state's actions require the defendant to move for a mistrial, if it's misconduct by the state, then the double jeopardy still attaches.
Attaches there. But does it matter that in this case the reason we're in the position of needing a mistrial is because the defense failed to disclose initially statements from the state's witnesses, and then when directed to make the disclosure, still failed to make the disclosure?
Your Honor, I guess I am unaware of any case law on the issue for the whether or not it was the defendant's an issue caused by the defendant one way or another or not. I believe I'm not aware of any case addressing that issue directly. I guess what I would posit, Your Honor, is that whether or not the actions of Mr. Kohler in this case were eventually what would cause the mistrial, what the issue is whether or not there was a step short of a mistrial that the district court could have done. That once jeopardy attaches, the defendant has the right to be heard by that jury on the issue, and that
the step short would be to say, I'm going to enforce my pretrial ruling that non-disclosed evidence won't be admissible. So that's the step short, but that is a step that defendant objected to. So it seems like that needs to factor into this analysis.
Your Honor, I think that's a step that the district court rejected as well. And the district court has discretion on the reconsidering prior rulings or whatever else. And if the court wants to view it that way, that the district court reconsidered its exclusion of non-disclosed evidence and as it relates to that, that's the district court has the right to do that under an abuse of discretion standard. And I don't think it abused the discretion because exclusion isn't the required remedy for a discovery violation. It's a possible remedy, but it's not a required.
I'm just wondering, under the case law, is there no room for consideration other than granting a continuance when determining whether there's been a manifest necessity? In other words, couldn't a court reason, well, yes, maybe I could go forward with this, but then I would be excluding evidence, which I think is important to the defense. Therefore, we do have a manifest necessity here. In order to allow the defense to present its case, we've got to give the state more time, and the way to do that is to just declare a mistrial and start over.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I fully follow your question.
I just wonder if the fact that the court was trying to do the defense a favor by allowing it to introduce evidence that clearly was inadmissible under the court's order. Like you said, the court changed its mind, reversed itself, therefore enabling the defense to present this information. Does that factor into our decision whether or not there was a manifest necessity, or are we solely like blinders on? Could there have been a one-day continuance if the answer is yes, manifest necessity? Or do other things factor into that analysis?
Your Honor, I believe it can be a consideration, but I do not believe it's dispositive. I believe the standard requires that all the alternatives to a mistrial are fully explored by the district court. And if the district court, it says if a continuance is unavailable and it's either exclusion or a mistrial and that they don't want to exclude the evidence and declare a mistrial, I believe that's a valid consideration. But what I'm saying, I guess my position is that in this case, the option of a continuance was not fully explored, I believe, in the record in this case. Simply declaring that a continuance is not feasible without factual support for it, when the factual support shows that a day continuance for sure would have been feasible in this case, and that there's no reason why a week or a month continuance, especially when those very same jurors, according to the record, would have been available or were still within their jury term to come back that month later, why that was not fully explored. And I'm in the same position at the court. I can only review what's on the record, and I don't see a reason in the record for why that wasn't explored.
Go ahead.
The state's brief to that point says on page 7 and onto the top of page 8, that the district court, when it came back and provided its explanation of manifest necessity, said that a continuance would not work because it had to dismiss those sworn jurors, because if they were to then, you know, be called for the subsequent case following the continuance, and this evidence was not admissible, they would have been tainted by this first violation.
And Your Honor, I would agree that that would be a very different situation. But you know, there hasn't been
my
a
My point is, I think the district court was looking at that in addition to its other considerations.
Your Honor, but I believe that puts the cart before the horse. I believe a continuance could have been put in place for them to push back a month. And if in that interim month it was decided that evidence that would not be admissible was heard by that jury, the court could cancel the jurors, say you don't have to come back in a month and declare a mistrial at that point. But it put the cart before the horse and said that because they made evidence that wasn't admissible, I'm going to preemptively declare a mistrial in this case. We still at this point do not know whether or not they heard anything that would be ultimately inadmissible. And I would posit that after disclosure, everything that was said in open statement and the opening statement was admissible. And so that there's nothing in the record saying that the jurors heard anything admissible and they didn't hear anything inadmissible, and the court erred by declaring a mistrial without fully exploring the continuance. Thank you.
Would you introduce yourself again for the record, please?
Your Honor, is Anthony Weigel, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Clay County. May it please the court, opposing counsel. First, the issue for the court, as already outlined, is whether or not the district court used its discretion in granting a mistrial. Again, we're talking an abuse of discretion standard here. The district court did not abuse its discretion in granting a mistrial, but rather appropriately found that appellants continued discovery violations before and during the jury trial warranted a mistrial due to manifest necessity. The court already noted that the judge, Your Honor, in this case, the district court had already ruled that that any evidence not disclosed prior to that Friday would not be allowed. You had additional evidence that was not disclosed came up during opening statements. Again, the judge went through the options at that point. The judge clearly could have just said, I ruled on this issue. There's a motion in limine ruling on this issue. That evidence is not allowed. It's how we got down to this road. The judge did not want to punish the appellant for the counsel's failure to timely disclose evidence. And the reason why it's a
counsel, just so that I understand the timing of it, the trial started on Tuesday, right?
Correct.
And the state expected, after, you know, back and forth about a, you know, whether they needed to subpoena the law clerk's notes in order to understand, in order to get the disclosure of the testimony or of the statement of the grandmother, the state understood that it was on Monday night that it was going to get that statement and or those notes, and that it was going to trial the next day. And it didn't ask for, I think it did not ask for a continuance based on that late disclosure at that time. It was ready to go on Tuesday, right? And so the question is, you know, they obviously didn't look at the email to understand what the notes said. So apparently they were ready to go the next day, and it was only during opening that they found out about what the statement was. And so if they were ready to go the next day, no matter what it said on Monday, why did they need any more time than just, you know, 12 hours to continue?
First, Your Honor, this is the chance for me to say the same thing that Mr. Hushka did. I was not only was I not trial counsel in this case, I did not brief this case. I'm just here today, but I do believe I have a sufficient understanding to answer that. And that is that I agree it doesn't look the best that email by opposing counsel was not read the next day. But my understanding is it was not read because the state believed it had to do with a witness that the state had already met with. This was a new witness. Again, that's my understanding of it, but it's a witness that the state had not previously spoken with, had not interviewed, had no knowledge that defense counsel interviewed. So yes, should our office have checked at that? Yes. But our office also understood that it was a witness that our office had previously met with. And when it came about,
they were mistaken about who they had met with.
Correct, Your Honor. That's my understanding, is that this was a whole nother witness that kind of came out of left field to the state the next day.
What, it was the grandmother, right, is the witness?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, was she on the state's witness list?
Your Honor, I don't information. I from my notes, I have that the victim's grandmother had not previously given a statement to law enforcement, nor had appellant disclosed to the state any conversations between the victim's grandmother and the defense investigator. My takeaway, again, is this all came out of left field. It was a witness that came out of left field.
I think she was subpoenaed. I thought, but I don't know that it was by the state, but I thought so. It seems like, in any event, the state was not really on top of its case with respect to ST. I mean, it seems like that witness seems to have been subpoenaed for trial, and they might have not fully appreciated, because they didn't look, that that person they had not previously interviewed before.
Yeah, and again, it's my understanding that the grandmother was present for the charged assault, and she broke it up and came to the girl's defense. So it's not like this is somebody who had nothing to do with the case, and we should be all that surprised. I mean, she was a witness to the alleged assault and came to the defense of the victim.
And Your Honor, again, I apologize. I don't know the ins and outs of it. What I'm here to address first is, I mean, there's no dispute. Yes, the state did not check that email the next day. But there's also no dispute that this was material information that was relevant to the defense, that the defense did not disclose, that the court very clearly articulated, the district courts did not disclose this information. Why should I allow it into evidence? The judge had already ruled under her motion in limine that anything not disclosed was not admissible. So, again, whether the state dropped the ball or not, the state dropped the ball after the defendant did not disclose, and I'm sorry I'm using the defendant, but after the appellant did not disclose information according to the rules of criminal procedure.
Right, so let's get to then the necessity of it, because my questions sort of go to, if the state thought they'd be ready to go with a disclosure on Monday night, and they get the disclosure on Tuesday, why couldn't they be ready to go then to respond to whatever the disclosure was on Wednesday? They obviously thought they would have enough time to do whatever they needed to do in response to the disclosure.
And again, Your Honor, I want to emphasize, I don't know the ins and outs, but I will say this, that my understanding is the state assumed this was going to be all right. There's a couple other statements there. This shouldn't be anything that should take more than an evening or the morning to address. I would note, and I think it's very, very telling, in appellant's brief, page 13, in support of appellant's claim that a continuance was warranted, appellant states a continuance to, quote, adjust strategy if necessary should have sufficed. So, I mean, this, it's quite big to say, judge, grant a continuance so that the state can adjust their trial strategy. That is telling of the information that was not disclosed. It isn't, you know, order of your witnesses or something like that. It's, judge, can we have 2 weeks? Can we have a month? Can we have 2 days? Because what I didn't disclose might make you rearrange your whole argument in this case. So, again, Your Honors, I believe that is a highly telling statement to say that a continuance to adjust trial strategy was warranted.
Are you arguing that the appellant consented to the mistrial? And can we decide that when the district court said that it did not decide it based on consent or find consent?
Yes, Your Honor. The state is arguing that the defendant, that the appellant impliedly consented for a couple reasons. Mistrial as an option was volunteered by the appellant. The options, when the district court asked what are the options from the state said exclusion. The appellant said a continuance or a mistrial.
And
mistrial,
if the district court did not make a finding of consent, and it's a factual question, is that something that you're saying we should make on appeal?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it is a factual question. It's not an inquiry of knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver. It's everything's on the record in this case, what the attorney said. And as it relates to appellant's claim that this is something that needs to be personally waived by the appellant, there's no case law that says that. There's one unpublished case that maybe suggests that. But mistrials, Your Honors, I've been an attorney for 13 years. I don't even know the ins and outs of mistrial law. I don't know how you think, and I don't know how the case law would suggest that a layperson without a law degree would understand the intricacies of a mistrial. Layperson defense understand the right to a speedy trial, the right to a jury, the right to cross-examine witnesses. But when you're talking manifest necessity, continuance versus mistrial, that's something that is beyond the comprehension of a layperson. There's nothing to support the position that you have to go over the standard for a mistrial with a, in this case, respondent with him in court and have him on the record waive any objection to a mistrial. There's just, yes, it's the state's position that, and as it comes back.
Counsel, when we look at the Hunter case, which is a case that you rely on a lot in your brief, the syllabus point for that says that whether a defendant has consented to the declaration of a mistrial is a factual question to be decided by the district court, reviewable on appeal for clear error. So back to that question of a factual finding, it seems like the case that you rely on actually requires a factual finding by the district court, which is why I'm wondering whether we should actually be making it here, since it's a clear error review.
And, Your Honor, two points on that. My first point is it's very hard. I understand the courts, the Court of Appeals, first to findings of fact by the district court. You're not in the position to weigh witness credibility, how someone saw it, sounded on the stand, demeanor, that stuff. But everything in this case is on the record. It's a legal decision whether or not the appellant in this case impliedly consented. It should be treated as a legal decision by Your Honors. Based on the record, everything, there's nothing that would fact, there's no additional facts that Your Honors don't have to make that determination. And then as it comes back to State versus Hunter and State versus White, and my former coworker is the one who wrote this brief, and he makes the great point. The standard, there's case law that says you can impliedly consent to a mistrial. It's oxymoronic. It's mutually exclusive to have case law that says you can impliedly consent to it, but then assert that a respondent has to consent to a mistrial on the record. If that were the requirement, there would be no such thing as impliedly consenting to a mistrial.
Counsel, can I ask a question about Hunter? Because I'm reading the standard from Hunter. If a defendant consents to a mistrial, he waives any claim that retrial is barred under the double jeopardy doctrine. If, on the other hand, the defendant objects to the declaration of a mistrial, double jeopardy bars a second trial unless a manifest necessity required the first trial to be terminated. And the thing I'm struggling with is we don't have a valid or an express consent, nor do we have an objection. So I'm wondering if we even get to manifest necessity as the standard if we don't actually have an objection to the declaration of the mistrial in the first place. Is there any case law that addresses that?
Your Honor, again, if I can use my one time to ask, can you clarify or repeat that question?
Yeah, Hunter says, if the defendant objects to the declaration of a mistrial, double jeopardy bars a second trial unless a manifest necessity required the first trial to be terminated. And we're focused here, it seems, on whether or not there was a manifest necessity. What I'm asking is, do we even get to that standard absent an objection to the mistrial in the first place?
Your Honor, I think what's paramount for the court here is there's kind of a ancillary, secondary issues. I think what the court just needs to keep in mind in this case, and I'll tell you, I certainly could have spent a lot more time on this, but I made sure to read State v. Gulib, Minnesota 2006. That case is dead on. And in that case, it was a mistrial occasioned by the defendant based on non-disclosure by the defendant. It related to a material issue at trial. The district court granted a mistrial rather than exclude the evidence, again, to be fair to the defendant and to ensure a fair trial. The district court in that case recessed to look at the judge's calendar, came back, decided a continuance was not warranted, that it also wasn't warranted to exclude the evidence and punish the defendant in that case for late disclosure and granted a mistrial. Your Honor, we've heard a lot today about whether or not a continuance was warranted. First of all, it's unreasonable to expect a judge to walk back into court and show to the counsels, here's my calendar for the next 3 days, hour by hour, why I can't do a continuance in this case. Your Honor, the other thing about it, none of this has been prefaced on, appellant's argument is no way prefaced on fairness. At no point does it say, we were 3 days into trial and I was confident that this was going to be a not guilty verdict, or that I have to bring in my expert witness again. This mistrial was during opening statements occasioned by the defense.
That's why it sounds like we're lacking an objection to me. I mean, if the defense counsel didn't want a mistrial because he or she was at the point in trial where he thought he was going to win, he would have objected. So I guess I'm agreeing with you on that point. I mean, we don't have an objection to the mistrial here, which I think has to factor into this, at least as the test is announced in Hunter.
Okay. And, Your Honor, with that, again, whether the court finds that the appellant impliedly consented or not, I'll just be clear, Your Honor. What I was trying to get at is, and I feel like I'm backing up my own claim that obviously mistrial law is very complicated, but this is not a complicated case. The concerns are fairness. The reason why you have a double jeopardy clause is to prevent oppressive actions by the state and forcing a defendant to continually defend himself or herself in court. There's none of those concerns in this case. This is a procedural argument by the appellant basically saying, hey, I snafu'd on Friday. I snafu'd again on Tuesday night. I got called out on it the next day. The judge did not accommodate my continuance request. I want to take advantage of the double jeopardy clause, and I want the state not to be able to restart over. And we'd be restarting with basically where we started. You have to swear in a jury and go back to opening arguments. This isn't one where the state, again, had called any expert witnesses. This was a fairness inquiry as it related to the appellant, and the judge found the most appropriate outcome was a mistrial to ensure fairness to the appellant in light of the nondisclosure. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. And if I would apologize in advance, I will be jumping around a bit to respond to some of the issues. On the issue of whether or not this is a factual decision, consent, I believe the court clearly outlined in Hunter a factual decision that, well, I would not mean to tell the court what to do, but this is an appellate court and not a fact-finding court, and that it should not reach factual decisions explicitly not determined by the district court. As for what the state put our position is, that it required the court to come out and put its calendar in the record for why or why not a continuance is not feasible. That we're not asking for the calendar to be put in the record. We're asking, though, for some explanation for why it could not be continued for one day or why it could not be continued the next week. It would be, say, there's no trial days available next week,
but
or there's counsel, no.
Wasn't that in Gulead? How is that any different than what happened in Gulead? I mean, Justice Page in dissent made exactly the statement that, argument that you're making in dissent, which is that the district court didn't explain its reason that a continuance wouldn't work.
Yes, Your Honor. And as for Gulead not being on point, we would believe that the issues in Gulead are different than what was not disclosed in this case. What happened in Gulead is that the expert witness actually conducted additional testing that was not disclosed to the state. What happened in this case was that there were statements, as the court said, was aware. It's the grandmother in this case, and the Clay County standard disclosure is that all witnesses identified in the reports are potential witnesses in this case. This is a witness the state was aware of, and it was simply statements and background that the state did not question her about. We would not believe it would be the state's position that if Mr. Kohler hadn't interviewed the grandmother beforehand and simply relied on evidence or information provided by the defendant and asked questions of the witness on the stand that the state didn't know about, that that's some type of disclosure. That happens all the time, that unexpected things come out on the stand.
Well, you really cannot make the argument this was not a discovery violation.
You seem to be trying to minimize the
conduct, and I don't think that's appropriate on these facts.
Not at all, Your Honor. I'm not trying to say there was not a discovery violation at all in this case.
But you're sort of saying the state could have done this, the state could have done that. I mean, the basis is this was a discovery violation by the defense.
Agreed, Your Honor. We're not disputing before the court that there was a discovery violation in this case. We're simply disputing whether or not what the proper remedy was that for and whether or not a continuance was explored by the court as is required by the case law. As for whether or not consent or an objection is required, Your Honor, I would point the state or point the court to State versus Olson. That's 609 Northwestern 2nd 293 cited in the briefs. In that case, the district court declared a sua sponte mistrial. That it was not an objection by the defendant in that case, and the court still considered whether or not there was consent. It's not whether or not an objection is formally raised. It's whether or not the defendant consented or did not consent. And I believe Olson clears that up, that there does not need to be a formal objection before whether or not manifest necessity becomes a relevant standard. Your Honor, again, I believe this case boils down to is whether or not there's evidence in the record for why or why not a continuance was not feasible. We're not saying that, I'm not trying to minimize what happened. I'm not trying to say that there was not a disclosure issue, but the issue is whether or not there is an objective manifestation, or an objective necessity apparent in the record. The case law is clear that it should not be only apparent to the district court, but that it should be obvious to any reviewing court. We believe that the factual record compiled before the district court does not create an obvious necessity in this case. The case of Dunkerley versus Hogan, 579 Federal 2nd 141. It's a Second Circuit case from 1978. It's cited in our opening brief. In that case, the court did not consider whether a 7 to 10 day continuance would suffice. Again, it's a federal case, so it's only persuasive. But the court said that the district court's failure to adequately consider whether or not a 7 to 10 days continuance foreclosed a finding of manifest necessity. We would again say the same is in this case, that the district court not outlining why a continuance was not feasible precludes a finding of manifest necessity. We would ask that the court reverse and remand with an order to dismiss. Unless there's any other questions, that concludes my argument.
No, thank you for the argument. The case is submitted.